bubbly beep bop, bop. Beep bop, bop me. Make way for the reaper, y'all.
Hey there, and welcome to Between Bikes with Nina Compton and Larry Miller, episode 13 of the 22-23 season. Today, pretty special person we get to sit here and chat with. Hannah Beekler is here. Nina's
best clap.
Welcome, Hannah.
Thank you for having me.
Hannah, you're the first Oscar winner that we've spoken with, I think, on the podcast. How did that change your life? Like, got a little bit more hectic?
It did. It got a little more hectic and just, you know, I would say press type stuff. And, you know, you're more visible after being on that show. So, or, you know, being seen. And it was sort of a historic moment
absolutely.
As well.
And
so
and
that
go
was...
back up, it was the Oscar for Best Production Design for Black Panther.
Yes, the first Black Panther.
First Black Panther. Your career happened pretty quickly, going from your first work as production design to an Oscar.
It did. It was really fast. You don't really know what to say because it's not seen like that. And when I say fast, it was probably like 5-6 years since my first film that got a lot of press, got a lot of, which was Fruitvale Station with Ryan and Coogler, who was the director, who was also the director of Black Panther. That wasn't very long. And so I think it was that, the quickness of it, that people were sort of like, there was some excitement surrounded around it. And then, you know, being the first Black person to win that award. To be nominated and to win. And it was very amplified. So it was very busy and it was a little weird because I'm used to being behind the camera, being quiet, you know, working quietly.
Well, tell us about that night. Walk us through being at the ceremony and hearing your name being called as the winner.
You know, I was kind of, in a place where I was really sure that I wasn't going to win. I was sure it was going to be Mary Poppins by John Muir, was the designer who's won every award he's ever gone up for when he was nominated. So I was just kind of like, I'm going to have fun. You know, I'm going to run around. I'm going to see stars, like people I fan out about.
So give us some names.
My son was with me. And it's a whole week of events that lead up to that.
Okay. So it sounds exhausting.
It was exhausting, but it was so much fun. I was in spaces that I was like at Diane von Furstenberg, had a lunch for all the female Oscar nominees across the board. So I'm like, show up to this, you know, black car comes and pick you up. And then I show up to her house in Beverly Hills.
Oof, I'm sure it's beautiful.
And it's absolutely stunning. It's like, does this even exist? You know, everybody's all dressed up and she's got this beautiful catered brunch and she made this fabulous speech and she had she flew a woman in from England who is a whistler and she whistled Over the Rainbow.
Oh, wow.
And it was absolutely just extraordinary. So I'm just talking to like Diane Warren and just hanging out with like Laura Dern and talking about Star Wars. Do you know, it was like Melissa McCarthy, and which then we got like, so they had like on your way out, there's a table of swag.
Oof.
You know.
Of course,
and
yes.
So everybody's kind of looking. It was like sunglasses and, you know, things of that nature. And I'm looking and I picked up a pair of sunglasses. And then I looked and I saw another pair and I picked them up. And Melissa McCarthy was like, I see you. Trying to take two.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I mean, I'm like stuffing them both in my purse. And she's like, I got my eyes on you. So we had this little thing. So when I saw her on the red carpet at the Oscars, like I'm on one side and she's on the other side. And I kind of looked over and saw her and she pointed at me and she's like, it's you. It's the eyes. It's a sunglass thief. You know, so we got a hug and you know, seeing Spike and Ruth, Spike Lee, I should say, Ruth Carter, who also made history that night. And, you know, just Adam Driver, my son and I were like, he's like, Kylo Ren. And I was like, let's go over there. And I would walk over. Can I get a picture with you? You know, so I was fangirl.
Yeah.
I was just like a probably bothered everybody, you know, from Helen Mirren. I got to hang out with Helen Mirren. Like, she just walked up and started talking to me. And
wow.
Christian Bale and Lady Gaga.
Oh,
that
wow.
was really, she's incredible. And, you know, she just, we were engaged in this conversation. It was like everything went away. And it's like, you're Lady Gaga, you know. And, you know, I work with Beyonce. And I'm like, Lady Gaga.
We won't tell Beyonce.
Of course, yeah. Right? Of course, I got to see people that I knew, like Barry Jenkins, who mm-hmm. I did Moonlight with. And so it was really fantastic. Regina King was there. She won that year as well. And that was really special for her, myself, and Ruth, just to be there in the moment together and, you know, hold each other and kind of jump up and down and scream a little bit, like, can you believe this? And so it was really great, you know. So you do the carpet, it's a lot of press. I got to the point where I was like, okay, I can't do any more press because it was just one thing after another. And did all of that, you know, it was great to have my son there and took all the pictures. I'm just going to enjoy the moment.
Yeah.
Again, I was like, I'm not going to win. I just knew how the Academy exactly voted, you know, and I'll take a centerpiece.
Right.
I'll walk out with something.
Yeah.
I'm going to take something out of here.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, under my dress. And so we're sitting there, and I didn't realize how fast it was going to come up. So they do Ruth, and I'm just like, Ruth, you know, yes, yes, yes. And then I'm like, oh, I've got like probably an hour or something. And then it was like production design. I was like, you know, and I just grabbed my son's hand and we kind of just stared at each other. We kind of just looked at each other's eyes. And I was just looking at him like, you know, it's a big deal no matter what happens.
Sure.
And then everything just went silent. It just stopped. Right. For me, it's like all of a sudden, like when you dive into water and it's like,
yes, yes.
And I can remember looking at him and he's smiling and, you know, I'm like, what's going on? You know what I mean? And then suddenly it just came back into like real. And he's like, get up. And I was like, what? I didn't hear them say my name. I didn't look at the stage when they were reading the, you know what I mean? I was so, it was almost like giving birth. Like you just need to like focus on somebody, you know, to get through it. And so I remember I stood up. I still wasn't really sure what was happening. And Fiona Crumby, who was the production designer on, I'm going to kick myself. She was the designer on the one about King George. Favorite. She was the production designer on Favorite. And we were first timers, right? So we were kind of the whole season just like, you and me. And I turned around and I saw Fiona and my first instinct was just to grab her and just hug her. So we had a big hug. And then I'm walking down the set decorator, Jay Hart, he's like pushing me out. He's like, we gotta go. And so I'm in the aisle and we're going down the aisle and I had that big train. So Jay kept stepping on the train, right? And so we get down and it's like Christian Bale on one side and Jason Momoa and Lisa Bonet on the other side. And Jay had stepped on my train and I started going forward and you know, my slit ripped.
Oh no.
And so Jason Momoa like grabs Jay and he's like, you're on our train and like moved him out of the way and like helped me with my train. And I'm like, and all I could think of was like, okay, Jason Momoa just helped me with my train. And Christian Bale's like, are you okay? And I'm like, and as I'm walking up the steps, I hear J-Lo. And like, I'm in these heels that are too big. Mm-hmm. So my feet are coming out of these because I didn't think, you know. One's gonna
right.
So I'm walking up and I'm just like, please don't fall. You know, Jennifer Lawrence it, you know, face plant on the steps. And I hear this voice. I hear J-Lo go, okay, girl, you got this. She's like one foot in front of the other. Like, I'm just looking forward and she's watching me shakily get up the steps. And she's like, you got this, one more step. And you're up and turn. So she's like guiding me. And so then, I gave her this speech and it was still all very blurred. You know, it was surreal and blurred.
What was the first thing you said when you got to that mic?
I said, New Orleans, you heard me?
Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
That was awesome. Now, that leads us to, you were not born in New Orleans.
No,
You were not raised in New Orleans.
No.
Neither were we. But we ended up falling for the city.
Yeah.
How did you make it here?
Well, so now my brother's wife was here.
Okay.
And he was in California, and they had known each other years previous and dated, you know, around college time. And then he was driving back home to Ohio. I'm originally from Ohio. And he's like, I'm going to take the Southern route. And he went through New Orleans. And he's like, oh, I'm going to call Barb. She taught at Sacred Heart and still teaches for Sacred Heart in D.C. They're in D.C. now. And, you know, the little romance sprung up again. Like, oh, okay, maybe this really was something. So they got married, like, in months, like 3 or 4 months later. Wow. And he just moved everything from California, and then they moved here. She was teaching at Sacred Heart. He was teaching on the West North Shore. He was making prosthetics on the North Shore at a little, orthopedic, gotcha. You know. So around, I was going to school in Ohio. I graduated from film school. This is around 2003. And my brother calls me and he's like, hey, you know, the secretary that works here, her cousin is a grip. And he was saying how there's films here. And I was like, New Orleans? Yeah. There's, okay, I'm going to go to L.A., you know what I mean? Like, right. New Orleans. And so I did. I kind of scouted out both places. I had a young son, and they just weren't affordable. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have any kind of, you know, people there. So he called me back, like a year later, he called me back. I'm graduating at this point. And he was like, I'm telling you, I see film trucks everywhere. And it was just at the beginning of that. And he's like, come down here, live with us, you know, we'll help with the, you know, baby, we'll get you set up. And I was like, okay, you know, I kind of begrudgingly was like, fine, New Orleans. Like, I don't, why am I going to the South? That's what I get, you know, and here comes the Yankee. And so that's how I got down here. And then I just sort of started really busting my ass and realizing there's a lot of work here. Mm-hmm. So it really was work driven. And then I had a network of people to help. And then Katrina. And they left to D.C. at that time. They ended up coming cleaning out their house. She got a job with Sacred Heart in D.C. And I had gone back up to Ohio, and literally probably like 4 weeks after Katrina, a job called me that was here, The Guardian. And they were supposed to shoot in New Orleans, but they were moving to Shreveport. Mm-hmm. And they're like, do you still want to come and work on this job?
That's a weird substitute for New Orleans.
I know.
That's some advanced set design if you made Shreveport.
That's right. Well, and I was the lower rung Shreveport. At that point. I was lifting stuff and carrying things and using the drill and doing electric. So I came back down to do that, was in Shreveport for 3 years while the infrastructure got back here for film. And as soon as it did, like everybody who was up there that worked in the business and film, everything just came back down to New Orleans again. So I've been here ever since. So almost like 18 years.
Wow. Yeah.
The going from film school to, and again, it's similar to everything that you go to law school, you get out and you're 100 hours a week doing research for partners in the firm. You go to film school, what's your first job working in the industry?
My very first job was cleaning floors in an art department on like a $2 budget feature film that was horrible. But it was Allison Eastwood, Clint Eastwood's daughter, was the producer, you know, and so that was like a big job and I got paid. So that was my first paying gig of like, you know, you're making, I think it was $600 a week, which is like $150. And to me, I was like, I'm paying rent.
Right.
You know, I'm paying bills. I'm doing great. And then I'm going to go shopping and buy new shoes. You know what I mean? Like that, I just felt good about that. And that was in Ohio. And once I got a kind of a taste of that, I was like, this is art department. That's where I'm supposed to be, I feel like. And I didn't really know where in the art department I wanted to end up at that time. To me, set decorating, because of the Coen brothers, set decorator Nancy Haig, I was like, she was, you know, the almighty to me at that time. And funny story, I wrote her a letter and like handwritten back in the day when you handwrite letters and you put a stamp, you put, and I sent it to her and like this address I found online. Mm-hmm. I was like, it says Nancy Higgs. There can't be that many Nancy Higgs in the world. And I sent it to her and probably like, you know, I guess a year later she called me.
Oh, wow.
And she was like, I think she just called because she wanted to, you know, vent. And she's like, this girl doesn't know me, so I hate this film that I'm on. You know, and so she vented a little and asked me some questions. And I told her, I was like, I want to be you. I want to be like you. And I, you know, fast forward to Wakanda Forever. I'm looking for a decorator. And I called Nancy Hang.
Wow.
And she was full circle. She was on a job. She's like, I'd love to do the job with you. And I said, do you remember the letter that I wrote to you? And she's like, no, I don't remember that. And I'm like, I wrote you a letter and you called me. And the last thing you wrote and the last thing you said to me on the phone call was, well, I hope you do well in the business. And she says, I guess you did okay. She's like, I should talk to people more often.
Yes, that's great.
So, yeah.
What were your parents' reactions when you said, I'm going to go to film school?
What?
You
can't make money at that. Okay, you do your little thing. Hannah's crazy. You know, like, she's just a big dreamer, and just let her do this. And, you know, my dad was like, oh, Lord, just come work with me, you know? And I don't think that they were really convinced or knew what I did or still know what I do. My father passed on the first Black Panther. He was an architect. So I was always like, I kind of do what you do. And he's like, mm-hmm. yes, and he did come and see one set. You know, and he was very like, it's not permanent, you know, where's the electric, you know? Okay. Yeah. But yeah, they were kind of skeptical, and I'd be like, oh, I'm doing this small horror film in Baton Rouge. And they'd be like, okay, air quotes, whatever you're doing, like, just as long as it's not illegal. And, so it took them a while, I think, before they realized like, oh, okay, you know, then I got the, I cut this out of the magazine.
Right.
You were in the magazine, you know, the scrapbook.
The scrapbook.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how long did it take, just give us a brief overview of the set in terms of from the vision to actually executing it?
And it will be different for a lot of different projects, mm-hmm. but if something like, let's talk about Wakanda Forever, since it's really the last big thing that I did, that in total was 2 years. And I know I'm exhausted just saying those words, which I essentially started in December 2019. So we were working through the pandemic, which made it extra hard. But in December 2019, and that was where it really started conceptually, where Ryan Coogler, the director, kind of first told me about Underwater World. Mm-hmm. You know, and I had to take a couple weeks. I was like, oh, I thought I was just gonna have to, you know, a whole new world. And so conceptually we started then, and the concepting was probably like a year of that. Mm-hmm. And then you go into the mode of building. So you take the concepts and the approved concepts, and then I sit down with draftspeople, modelers, my art directors, my set designers, I have a huge team, my coordinator, my construction coordinators, my set decorators, you know, in all it's a team. If I included every person throughout the construction and paint department, which is largely the biggest department, probably about 600 people
wow.
or so at any given time. And so I sit down with everybody and then we start breaking down the concept of what are we going to build and what's going to be blue screen. You know, what does special effects need? What does visual effects need mm-hmm. for us to build? And because there's a lot of little pieces, like there's the big giant sets, which we had a ton of.
Right.
And then there's the little pieces that we build, like, you know, the Sunbird, we just built the cockpit, but we built, you know, blue wings that would be, so VFX knows what the shape is and how big they are.
Wow.
But the finishes and things we can't do because right. that doesn't exist. Vibranium is not real.
Right.
I was like, bring in the vibranium, please.
What?
Oh, wait, no? There's no vibranium, I see. So there's things like that. So it's a lot of engineering, especially since we had water.
Tell me about, because that was, how big was the underwater world that you constructed?
Because we had a lot of tanks.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the biggest tank, well, we had a tank that was like 80 feet in diameter, it was 20 feet deep. that was on stage.
Wow.
You know, and that was to do, like, the scene where we have the big Megalodon jaw, that got dropped into that tank.
Okay.
So then they were like, we need something bigger. And, you know, it's Marvel. So I was like, hey, just a thought. Why don't we dig a tank in the parking lot of the studio, the stages, the back lot? So I was like, you know, then we can do all the bigger pieces in there, all the swimming back and forth,
right.
The boat that goes up under the thing. We can have people diving off of 20-foot platforms into it, which we did.
Mm-hmm.
And we can blow stuff up. And we'll just build the set onto that. So that set alone was probably a couple football fields big.
Wow.
It was its own city.
Oh, my gosh.
So when a budget is established for a film.
Mm-hmm.
We won't get into whether or not you stick to budget. They carve out a piece for production design.
Mm-hmm.
And that encompasses everything visually, basically, you see. Is
yes,
that correct?
That's right.
How do you... That was a good example. How do you stick to that budget knowing that, oh, wait a minute, now we're going to go dig out on the lot?
I mean, there's a lot of horse trading that goes on.
Okay.
With like, okay, well, this is really necessary because we can use it for many, many things.
Mm-hmm.
Across the entire film, you know, and then I'm like, and then we'll put the set on it. So the numbers kind of crunch together in that way. So that those numbers are coming from different places, or we find more money depending on how much we feel we need it. And then, you know, you go, you know, it's above me now.
Right.
And y'all can go talk about that with the higher ups.
That's a luxury on a production. The sequel to Black Panther,
yes.
Obviously, it's easier to go and ask for money there. Fruitvale Station was a different story, huh?
Absolutely. Okay, look, on Fruitvale Station, it was me and one other person in the entire art department. And Payam, who I'll never forget. And he was trying to get to Burning Man. And that was like his big thing. Like he really wasn't interested in what we were doing, but he had to get to Burning Man. And so we did spend a lot of time making videos of him to win tickets. It was fun. And I think my budget on that was, for the entire art department, was probably a little over $4,000.
Wow.
Well, one of the things I've read...
That's crazy.
Saying it out loud, it's like, we did that.
Yes.
And it's one of the things that is extremely cool. Actually, that kind of plays into... after we're done here, we're going to our other restaurant, Compare Le Pen, is a
mm-hmm.
rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to buy all the bunnies that are on sale. For, but
we're
keeping
bunny
that
hunting.
Within... We're bunny hunting. But one of the things you did in Fruitvale... That was your BART card, the Bay Area Rapid Transit,
mm-hmm.
in the visor.
Yeah.
How do you ever sit back and say, that was kind of cool that I came up with that, that this shot needs, you need to have a BART card in there.
Yeah.
Go to the purse, pull it out, and stick it up there.
Yeah.
Does that, it just happens because you think of it at the moment?
Yeah.
Do you ever look back and go, wow, that was pretty cool? Or it's just, okay, good. Good. No, that's important.
Because you kind of look, you do everything that you can theoretically. Like, I've gathered all this stuff that now I know I'm going to go put in there. And then you kind of step back and look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, wait, that doesn't make sense. He would have that. He would absolutely, and he would have it in his visor, you know, because the conversation with his mother is around taking the BART,
mm-hmm.
and then everything that happens in the BART. So, and I was like, and I did, I ran around to a couple people. I'm like, who's got a truck? And then I like, oh yes, I have one in my pocket. And I happened to have one in my pocket. So, and put that in there. And then, you know, the fact that, you know, it was in, and Ryan was like, that was awesome. That was awesome, you know, because he was so about, I mean, he is, not was, is. I mean, his town is everything to him. And I understand that living in New Orleans, you know, it's like, I can love and hate it, but nobody else can hate it.
Right.
I don't want to hear any bad words if you don't live here.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you live here? That's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about
it. Then you say, yeah, you're right.
That's, you know,
yeah.
But it is. So it's very close to him and very dear to him. And I think in the same way that this city is to me, Of course, he was born and raised there. Mm-hmm. And so that those little things, those little details is what I learned from him and got and carried on into my career and, you know, really became a part of my aesthetic when I build a world.
How did you meet and end up? You just clicked right away. He does a really admirable job of kind of keeping the group of pirates together.
Yep, he does.
Through different projects. How did that start?
You know, I remember I was on Napoleon and I pulled over crying because I was like, I'm never gonna, you know, do this. You know, I can't find work and I want to be a designer and I was just really down. And my mentor, Wynn Thomas, who's Spike Lee's designer, production designer, called me at that moment. And he kind of said to me, you know, I thought he was going to be like, oh, poor girl. And he was not. He was like, get your shit together. I was like, oh, okay. This isn't going to be one of those fluffy moments. And he kind of, you know, got me together. And he said, go get an agent, as if that's so easy. Yeah. Go get an agent, you know, do these things and only do films that you love, that the script means something, that should be in the world. He said those words to me.
Right.
3 weeks later, after a lot of emails and phone calls, I did get an agent. And the first script, she's like, okay, so there's this really young guy in San Francisco, and he's doing this really itty bitty little tiny film there, and the script is great. You should read it. And I was like, and he has no money to bring you there. And I was like, oh, okay, I'll read it. And I was kind of like, I don't want to do that. But I read it, and it was just like my heart. I'm like, I have to do this. So I was like, I called her, and I was like, I want to meet with him, and I want to talk about it. And so it was over Skype. Poor Skype. Womp womp. It was over Skype. And it was so funny because there were so many technical difficulties. Like, we couldn't get the screen. The screen was flipped upside down. So I'm like holding my computer weird. And then I kind of made a collage on my wall, so I'm holding my computer up to the wall so he can see it through the camera. Like, I didn't know how to do it right because I'd never been on a Skype meeting, and I didn't realize, like, I should have just sent him a file of stuff.
Right.
I didn't even know. So we had this conversation, and he asked me some questions, and I just thought, gosh, he's so young, because he was 24 at the time.
Wow.
And he was still at USC. And so I was like, you know, but he was really, like, everything he said, it was like, wow, this kid is on it. You know, he's really smart, and I really want to, like, his vision is really great. Like, I understand it. Like, I understood what he was saying, you know? Sometimes it just comes easy when you can get what someone is telling you. And so he's like, you know, we're going to talk to other designers, and we'll get back to you in a week or so. And I was like, okay. And I remember jumping up and down on my bed, and I was all excited, like, this is great. And then my Skype rings, and I'm like, why is my Skype ringing? And it was weird. So I, like, I was like, hello? And he's like, comes up upside down again. And he's like, yeah. It was like 45 minutes later, and he was like, do you want the job? And I was like, yeah.
Wow.
And that's how I met Ryan Coogler. And so I drove from New Orleans to San Francisco, like 3 months later, by myself, and immediately, like, arrived there. I dog sat because I couldn't afford to, you know, Airbnb was just starting to be a thing, and I couldn't afford a hotel or to rent an apartment. So I found people who needed their dog sat for the entire time that I was gone. So two different sets of dogs, a Dalmatian and three corgis, and did that, got to the first set of dogs, and then went and met Ryan in person at his grandmother's house, Grandma Susie, whose house was actually the headquarters for the Black Panthers in 1968.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, and then his two aunts lived on either side, and they were twins, Marilyn and Carolyn, and those three houses became our sets. All our interiors were done in those three houses, and I just built, like, an addition onto the kitchen in Grandma Susie's house, and then we use Marilyn's house for, like, the bedroom in the opening scene for Fruitvale. So we very much, like, had to cobble together, and we built, and we went to the Habitat for Humanity to get, like, kitchen pieces, mm-hmm. And found people in the, you know, Craigslist who were giving away free things that we needed.
Wow.
You know, the car that we found, we borrowed from one of Ryan's friends for Michael. And, you know, the big get was being able to film in the BART. That was the big expense, and that was what we needed to do in Fruitvale Station BART.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So it's from that you went to do videos with Beyoncé.
Yeah.
The Queen Bee.
Yeah.
How was that? Yes.
We were in New Orleans doing Lemonade for about 2 weeks. That was funny because when they called me, they didn't say who it was. They were like, pop star. And I was like, pop star? Taylor Swift? No, I don't want to do that. You know what I mean? I was like, I can't see myself doing a Taylor Swift video. And I thought it was just one video. I didn't even know. And then I said no. And then they called 2 weeks later and they're like, hey, you know, are you sure? You know? And I was like, well, it's around Christmas time. Everybody could use a paycheck.
Right.
So I was like, sure, why not? It can't kill me.
Right.
And it's here in New Orleans. And I really want to be home and work because, you know, I'm away a lot. And so that felt good. And I could work with my friends, you know, that I hadn't worked with in a long time. And so I go to the hotel and they're like, Lemonade is coming up. And I was like, oh, that must be the pop star. And I texted my son. And I was like, look up Lemonade. Who's Lemonade? What pop star is that? You know, is that some new person on the scene? Is that a rapper? Like, who is that? And then I'm sitting there talking to the producers. I'm like, oh, Lemonade's here. And I turn around and it's Beyonce. And I was like,
God,
you know what I mean? I like grab my chest. I'm like trying not to have a coronary. And she was so lovely. Like she came over and she was talking to me. And you know, sometimes like I just stared at her. Like she was talking, but I'm just like looking at her face like, you really are that gorgeous.
Yes,
like
yes.
There is not a flaw. Like you have no makeup on and there's no flaw. Like I'm just sort of like looking. And I knew she knew what I was doing because she kind of was like, okay, like this happens every time I talk to somebody new. And then she's absolutely lovely and gave me tons of freedom, sort of explained what she wanted to do and the places she wanted to shoot that were important to her. Her whole family there was there. Solange was there, who lives here with her son and husband. And Jay was there. And then we just got on really well. And then she called me again to do a project in Jamaica and for Baychella, as they call it, to do some concept development for that. And then we did some Black is King. So, and then for Renaissance, she had called. I was not available. I was working on a show in Boston. And but yeah, she just keeps calling.
What's it like telling Beyonce you're not available?
Right? You want to make sure. You want to make sure that she knows exactly why you're not available.
Can't tell the queen no.
It's like, I'm literally stuck in Boston. I'm on a job. I'm working. I can't leave. I can't get out of it. You know, here's the producer's phone number. Here's the schedule. Here's the one-liner. I love you. I love you. I love you. Please call me again. I would love to be there for you, but I can't do it this time. And so, yeah. And she calls pretty consistently. So I really like being part of her team, and I love being part of Ryan's team, who, you know, I find myself in these places where I'm kind of, you want to find your family in the film industry to continue to work with. I mean, you look at the great teams like Scorsese and Dante Ferretti have been together for 25 years. Don Burt and David Fincher have been together for, you know, since the beginning of his career. Howard and Soderbergh, who actually did Soderbergh film because Howard wasn't available, but they've been together since The Oceans. So it's kind of a coveted place to be.
Right. And have you seen in your career and basically working with Ryan, does he loosen up? Like now does he not even think about the whole set design that you're on the same page and he trusts you?
Yeah.
How was it early on?
I mean, early on, well, see, Ryan's such a humble man that he knew he was learning when we, like, on Fruitvale Station. Again, we didn't have much, but I always like to treat every project the same, with the same importance and the same process, whether it's a little bit smaller or bigger, just to give it that dignity and reverence. And so he really took time to listen. And then we would have these debates and conversations about, you know, the theory of why something wanted to be like something, which was very exciting. And so I got to learn him and he got to learn me. And then we understood that while our perspectives are different, we were basically looking at the same thing. So we got there using a piece of both of us. And now he just will tell me a story about, now he just is kind of like, okay, I need you to, all right, this is when we have an underwater world, I need you to do an underwater world, and I'll just go, right? And then he'll tell me a story about, like, the people. He's about people, and so, like, how they lived, you know, the things he wants them to be able to do, and community, and, you know, it's really important for people to be eating for him, and how do they have a food source, like, really kind of hard sci-fi. And so I just go and then develop that, you know, and there's a design that comes from that. And we just have a shorthand. It's always been real quick with us. Like, we'll go into a location and look at each other, and he'll be like, bounce? And I'll be like, yeah, bounce. Yeah. We don't need a whole lot of, you know, we can kind of feel, like, how that goes. And so he's, you know, a very important filmmaker for me career-wise, but also just as a friend, yeah.
That's pretty amazing, yeah, to be together at that level, which both of you at the time thought was incredible and were making a film, and then to expand as impressively as your both of your careers have happened.
So on, you're a very busy lady, you travel a lot. What do you do in your downtime?
I mean, there's not a lot of downtime, but oddly enough, people are always like, what? My, like, really relaxing hobby is racing cars.
Oh, wow.
Porsches.
What kind of car?
You Porsches. Race them or you watch them?
No, I drive them. I Whoa. Drive them. I like to get on a track, and I like to go fast. I like my Carrera 4S with a mid-engine.
Good for you. We're
going to have to put some earmuffs on.
You didn't see the big old engine car I pulled up in. That's 25 horsepower with, you know, 5.5 liter 8-cylinder.
Oh, you go fast.
I like to drive fast. Good. That's an automatic. I haven't driven a manual in a long time, but you really like go fast in that. I like to rally. I will rally drive. So that and it's my dad's fault. I will blame it squarely on my father. For that one, he was a wild driver, and he instilled that in his children. Like, he would race us. He would be like when we all turned 16, 17, we had cars. We would be someplace, like at a wedding, and my dad would be like, okay, who's gonna get home first? And we'd all hop in our cars and shoot off all different directions.
There go the beeklers.
That's right. And people knew.
Everybody get off the road.
I'd be driving next to my brother looking at him right like, you know I'm gonna beat you.
Right.
So he kind of like was bad for that, my dad. But so, and I found, and maybe that's why I find it a little relaxing, or does remind me of him. But yeah, it's also, you know, you have to be really focused. You have to really, it's strategic. You have to understand the mechanics and the engineering of the vehicle that you're in. So it, all of that, you know, my son would say you're not relaxing because of how much work it is, sort
yes.
of, to control a
you're
vehicle like that.
That's what it is.
I'm competitive.
Yes.
I am. And that's the other thing. I grew up in a sports family, and 100% we were competitive with each other. We were competitive all through our youth in high school, and, you know.
What sports?
Track.
Oh, wow.
Running.
What did you run?
I ran the 100 hurdles and the 400 400 shuttle hurdles, 4x1, mm-hmm. 4x2.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was very competitive. And my brothers really went far with that. You know, my one brother went to Olympic trials.
Oh,
he
had, wow.
He pulled a hamstring and was unable to continue at that point. So his career ended. My other brother ran for Clemson. He was at IU. My other brother ran for Clemson back in the fridge days.
Oh, yeah.
Back in the day of the fridge. Death
Nina
Valley.
Doesn't remember the fridge.
No.
But
uh-huh.
William the Refrigerator Perry,
uh-huh.
huge defensive tackle, and they would uh-huh. put him in on the goal line, and they would hand him the ball, and nobody
could get through.
Yeah,
that's
it. They called him the fridge. And yeah, back in when Death Valley first came up in Clemson. So it was like a big deal. It was part of our whole life. So the yeah. competition was there on the track, off the track, you know, everything was turned into some type
yes.
of competition.
I love that.
When you are away from town, and let's say some major production like Wakanda Forever or, you know, Black Panther or Creed, What do you miss most about New Orleans?
Everything. It was really hard at the end of Panther to be away. So I was coming back every weekend, like literally weekend. And because right after Panther, then I came back. I was here for a couple months, but then I went to Boston for 6 months. And I knew right then when I got to Boston that I was coming home every weekend. So I had an assistant that stays at the house because of my dog. I don't travel my dog. She's so old. And just having to get my housework done too. But every weekend I came home because I just, it was too hard. You'd get homesick from here.
Yeah.
I can't imagine living someplace where you're like, yeah, I'm good. You know what I mean? Like, I don't need to go back.
Right.
I just miss my neighbors. I miss my neighborhood because it's really community oriented. Like, I know all my neighbors. Mm-hmm. We talk. Like, I can be like, Miss Gloria, can I get a, you know, cup of sugar? Like, you know, I have friends who live in LA that they don't even know who's next door. Yeah. I miss walking outside and seeing like 10 horses going down Annunciation. Like, what is going on? You know what I mean? Like the whimsy of New Orleans.
Yep.
I miss the weather. It's cold everywhere. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know what I mean? Everywhere I go, I'm like, oh my gosh, why is it snowing in LA? Like, it's 75 in New Orleans. I hate it here. You know, and I just miss my home. The uniqueness of the architecture. Like, I'm at a place, I think, just from what I do, where I would need to be someplace where aesthetically it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't want to just look at 10 things that look exactly the same or don't have any character, don't have a story. And it's important for me to be surrounded by that kind of art, in architecture, in just everything, which is New Orleans. It's the most unique city in the country.
Yes.
It doesn't matter what country I'm in. Literally, I can be. I was in Orbi Gorge in South Africa, and I'm telling you, on a farm, and the guy who owned it, because we were eating it there, and he was like, you know, where are you from? I was like, New Orleans. He's like, New Orleans! I was like, now, I'm out in the middle of nowhere, and I'm sure that baboon is stalking us. And he knew New Orleans.
Yes.
Everywhere I go, it doesn't really matter.
And they love it.
They're like, jazz, music, and food. And, you must love living there. And I'm like, yes, I do, and I'm going to go home. So I do miss it all the time, and I'm away a lot. But I find my way. I find a way to get back.
Yeah. So nowadays, do you... How does it feel when people call and say we'd like you on this project, but you don't either feel the project or you're rolling your eyes like, why are they even calling me? How does that process work now? And that is, are people calling you or your agent every week with something?
You know, yeah, they call my agent. I don't have to deal with those phone calls anymore,
nice.
You know, which is really nice. And there, I mean, some wild stuff comes up. So there's always offers.
Wild good or wild bad?
Good. I mean, weird, maybe. Like, things that, like, I would never think of me for that, you know? And there's a lot of great stuff that comes in. And there's always projects that it's just like, that's not me. You know, I can remember after the first Panther where they called me about the Barbie project. And it was like, I don't, you know what I mean? I can't see myself. And it was more about world building. Like, at that point, you know, people saw Wakanda and they were like, what? You know, we haven't seen anything like that. So it's getting a lot of those phone calls to build worlds. But I still want the project to mean something to me, no matter how big it is. Like, that piece of advice I'll always carry. So it is kind of nice to be able to pick and choose projects and not really work like I just need to make money work, which is, I think, a privilege and can be rare in this world. To decide. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of work that went before that. So that's been really great. And my agent does a wonderful job of dealing with that. And we have a lot of big conversations about certain things. And there's different reasons also to do things, experience. Like, I'm now doing the Broadway revival of The Wiz in New York.
Wow.
And, you know, I really am interested in stage. And it's The Wiz. So that, I mean, it happened to be The Wiz. I mean, if it was something else, maybe I'd have said no, but it was intriguing to me to put myself in a place of that's outside my wheelhouse that maybe I'm a little uncomfortable. I need to learn and I need to observe and I need to be quiet and lean on the experts. But also create a world in a way that I haven't before. Like, can I do this?
Well, it's so a lot more different. First of all, there's no CGI.
That's right.
On Broadway. Yes. I'm guessing you only have a limited amount of set changes.
Through
a play. As you came up, you faced a challenging time where when you started, there was not a lot of CGI. You could do explosions and things that.
Everything.
But now you could actually make a whole film CGI. But as you were speaking about earlier, when you would blue screen something and show them the shape and the size, how big an impact has that made on your work on films, that your ability to know what the nerds can do with all the technology, but have that still tie into your vision of that production or that design?
You know, it's one of those things where it's like, it can be good and it can be maybe a little scary for my job, you know? And because, you know, you look at something like Avatar and that was basically all VFX. And they didn't, you know, the people who were acting as designers were VFX people. So they didn't, you know what I mean? Like, so you're kind of like, ugh. But when I'm working with that, for me, Ryan and I had always said VFX will always be background. Unless it's something we, you know, cannot do in the foreground, like some of the technology and things like that, some of the things moving. So I build, and we really went to bat for that pretty hard, because Marvel isn't known for that up until Wakanda. Right. We built a pretty much all of it. So they were kind of like, oh my gosh, what are you doing? We thought you would just build like a little piece of the ground and then the movie affects everything. I pretty much, for me, I can't speak for every designer on the Black Panthers, designed the entire world. So I knew what was going to be in the place of the blue practical piece.
Gotcha.
I designed the aircrafts in full. So we all look at it and we can animate them. So I have people doing animations of those things so we know how they work. And all of those things get handed over to the VFX and I continue to work with them on like, this is what it is. And so I need you to do this.
Wow.
They're just kind of doing that and then making it real. You know, there's some redesigns that they'll do. They'll zhuzh some things based on the shot because the VFX are done per the shot. If they don't work logistically within the design that I've made, or there's a piece of the design that they don't know what that is, mm-hmm. and I'm not available to sort of redesign it, they'll do something. But for the most part, everything you see is what I have designed, whether it's VFX or not. So yeah, they get exactly what I'm designing,
yes.
And then they make that. So it helps also in us understanding what that VFX is, because I can have the illustrations there for the actors, for the director to be like, okay, here's our build, and then behind it, this is what it looks like, you know. And they can feel, oh, okay, I see more of the city, or the palace is over there. And so they kind of know where everything is and what the bigger world is in those particular spaces. But I'm one to push back. I'm using too many VFX in that way. The other thing about it is that you can imagine that type of a world, knowing that it can get built in VFX. It's also limited. I mean, it's still expensive. And we can't do everything that way, so things get cut or reimagined. But yeah.
Why is it so expensive?
Because of how many frames you have to do. And I mean, you know, you have to VFX that thing in each frame.
Right.
So 24 frames per second. And if you've got 4, 5, 10 minute scenes, that can get up there. And if you're doing big pieces of the frame as well, because, you know, as the camera moves, you kind of got to zhuzh it. And that's why we did so much in camera, which is lovely. There's that real texture to it. Sometimes they'll enhance it with VFX, which that's a Ryan call.
Gotcha.
And the executives at Marvel. And you know, I've talked to other designers and we all kind of have the same feeling, like, you know, me having some, you know, voice in the post-production VFX is something I have to go to bat for before I even come on the job. Normally, designers aren't, you know, and I remember talking to another designer, and he was like, oh, no, I had that put in my contract, because you do want to make sure that things are cohesive, and you don't want to show up in the theater and be like,
right,
my, what is that?
Well, that was going to be my next question. Are you able to go to movies and watch the movie? You're looking at design.
I'm looking at design. I'm like, okay, I'm taking mental notes.
Sounds like eating with a chef.
Uh-huh, exactly. Somebody's going to have a conversation. Let's have a conversation about that little piece. And so I don't really watch them. If I go to the premiere, I'll watch them then, and then I don't watch them again. And the only one, and I always tell Ryan this, he's always like, really? The only movie that I can watch over and over and over and over and over again, kind of like the, Bourne movies, like it comes on and you're just like, yeah. Because for some reason, it's like Law and Order and Bourne. Like I can just have those on constantly, like it's a new thing. Is Creed, the first Creed.
Yeah.
I can watch all the Creeds because they're all really great. But that, I can watch it over and over and over again and feel very satisfied about what I'm seeing. And maybe that's why I can watch it over and over again. Because I don't pick on it. I don't pick on the things that happened in it, as far as the design. I'm not like looking at the...
Hypercritical.
Yes. I am hypercritical.
Are there any old movies, like black and white, that you watched growing up or you've been able to reflect now that you do this professionally, like maybe that had an impact on you and the way you look at making a film?
Oh, absolutely. Like I was stuck in front of the television, and then it would sign off at midnight. Like that's how long ago when the flag came up and then it went to the color bars. They didn't have remotes then. Yep. And I watched probably every single Fred Astaire film, every single, what's her name, the swimming woman, Edith, she had a bathing suit line, and she did all those big stage synchronized swimming, like every one of those, what is her name, all of the, like Betty Davis, and all of those movies of like, I'm looking into the heart of an artichoke, Eve, all about Eve. And like these big, and then the Westerns, like Sergio Leone's, all of the Clint Eastwood's, the trilogy, Good, Bad, and the Ugly, like all of that. Chisholm, I loved it. Stagecoach, loved it. I watched those movies because I when I was just, and then, I started getting into the Star Wars and the Cat from Outer Space and things like that, into the more fantasy stuff. But those movies, there's what I came up on. And the fantasy of it all. Mm-hmm. The Tux, the Ginger Rogers, the, him dancing up the wall. How did they do that? My little 8-year-old brain went, and, the giant sets that were intricate, right? They have a pool with the stairs that go around. This is crazy. And she's diving off into this water and they're on a stage, and then all the beautiful outfits and the Rita Hayworth, all of it.
I almost had her name when you talked about diving off.
And it's right on the ticket. Merle. I can't remember. But all of the Elvis movies when Elvis was acting, and all of the Annette and Frankie, right on the beach, it's beach blanket bingo.
Right. Yes.
All of that, and it was all fantasy with the backdrops, and it was very Hollywood, right, at that time.
Very, very glam. I watched glam. An Affair to Remember with Cary Grant. Okay. It's Cary Grant? Yes.
Yeah.
And it's just the way that they dress, just to go to dinner.
Mm-hmm.
These grand ball gowns.
I don't understand how they packed. They're always in a hotel.
They had trunks that other people dealt with.
And the diamonds. And just everything was...
The collars.
Nothing was casual. It was always black tie for any occasion.
That's right. North by Northwest was another great one. It's like the train. We're traveling in this beautiful train with my trunks and the pinched waist dresses and the poodle. It's just It was fantasy.
Yes.
You know?
Esther Williams!
We got it. I said Edith, so, you know, the over-under on that is that I won. That stuff really had an impact. And then with what my father did as an architect, because he'd always take me on jobs and to sites and stuff like that and really talk to me about, he built the house we grew up in, I helped him build the guest house, mm-hmm. you know, he built the barn, and I was always out there. I was the only one that cared, I think, so I was always there. He was like, can't all do it?
Yeah.
And pointing out, like, what types of architecture we're seeing as we're driving and what that means and the history of that. So mm-hmm. with that and then this, like, kind of fantasy other world that I would go off into the television, I mean, it was sort of inevitable that I'd be doing something in this realm.
Something creative. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. I think a lot of people, you know, your childhood is so impactful on your journey. And when you think back, it's pretty powerful.
Yeah, it is. It's like my son was always like, his father's a musician. I do what I do. But he was very science-based, super science-based, you know, nerd, you know, D&D and Magic the Gathering, if you can imagine. So now he's like, oh yeah, I'm making this campaign for Dungeons and Dragons. I'm creating this world. I'm building this world. I'm like, oh, kind of like what I do. And he's like, no, this has nothing to do with what you do at all. Like, and I'm like, oh, I must have been the same way when, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I don't do what my dad does. Yeah, I don't want anything to do with that. So yeah, I see that it kind of shit presents itself. You don't even know it.
One of the other great things you've gotten to do is the Metropolitan Museum of Art gave you a call, said we want you to curate an exhibit.
Yeah.
What was how do you, in a film, you spend however long filming in different times and then put it together. When you're curating an exhibit, it just sits there and the people move by.
Mm-hmm.
How was that a challenge? Was it a challenge?
I mean,
was it just exciting?
I'm not really like.
Did you freak out over it?
I did, because I was like, what? Like, I'm not really a part of the art world in that way. Mm-hmm. You know, I have my knowledge, but not, you know, I don't have a PhD in art like all the people that I worked with did. I was like, oh, I didn't know they give PhDs for that. You know, so it was a challenge. It's another challenge in being the competitive sort of person that I am. You know, I wanted to meet the challenge and I wanted to learn. I thought this is a really another great way to exercise your creativity, to use a different part of that muscle. And I'm outside of my wheelhouse and, you know, putting myself in this place was a little uncomfortable, but I guess I like to be in those positions. And at first when they approached me, they asked me to consult about Afrofuturism. And I was like, oh, okay. And, you know, I talked to the director and I was like, oh, she was like, you know, just give us a little, you know, let's have a meeting and you can kind of tell us about Afrofuturism and how you designed, you know, Wakanda and everything. And you know, I'll send you like where the space is so you can kind of like if you have any ideas. And so I got on the meeting. I was like, here's the exhibit. They were like, excuse, you know, like what? I was kind of like, I started designing this thing. This is kind of my default, right? Mm-hmm. Is to like, okay, well, if we're talking about the specific thing, Seneca Village, you know, it should be a whole structure inside of the building.
Sure.
And they're like, oh, you mean like a house, in the building? And I was like, yeah, design a whole structure like a set. That's my default. Mm-hmm. So I kind of started doing that. And they're like, they asked me, do you want to curate this? Because I started pulling in different artists from all over the diaspora that wanted their voices to be a part of this. And, you know, Met really wanted to use a lot of their collection, which did not include a lot of Black artists throughout time. And I said, look, I will be more than happy to do this. I think what's necessary here is that anything that we put in this exhibit joins the Met's collection, and that we start then not just making exhibits about the Black voice, but you need to start collecting items about the Black voice, you know, and change how the Met now is working and looking at future artists. And if we're going to talk about the future, let's talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, okay, so that was a beautiful thing that all of these artists' work are now part of their collection. Yeah. And that's a big deal in 150 years of not having that.
Right.
You know, of course there was a Basquiat there, but it's Basquiat, you know what I mean? Like, that's a given. Right. But so this is, and that was my goal, is like, now we need to, if we're going to change things, let's change things. And so that was the beautiful part. And the working with the Met was fabulous. So it was a really fantastic experience to meet all these artists, to envision what the past and the future means in an Afrofuturist way. And then to know, I think like 3 or 4 months ago when I went back out to do a conversation about the exhibit, I was told by the Met director that that exhibit has brought more visitors than any exhibit.
Oh, wow.
In a year. And so now they're elongating the time that it will be at the Met. So it's been hugely successful.
We should go and meet.
Awesome. And it'll be up there in a couple weeks.
Absolutely. It'll be there for 5 years.
Oh, wow. And congrats. Wow.
Yeah. So it's really, really exciting. And I think there's a lot to do with it, because my suggestion to them, it was like, this is my perspective and my voice. But what happens if we keep the structure, we clean it out, and we bring another artist's voice in? So it can be here for these 5 years, but let's bring a different perspective of what this world should be like. I can't be the only voice. And that's how we have to start looking at the future. It's not one voice.
Yeah.
It's several voices. So let's start doing that. Like, bring a group of kids in who are artists and let them go to town. You know, what can we do? What can we bring? And what can we put in the world? So those are the types of things where I see a project like that and then understand how far it can go.
Did you surprise yourself being that direct and assertive with the director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art? I mean, it's amazing.
You know,
I mean, that's a boss move.
You have to have the conversations that aren't the most comfortable. And I think on that specific project, I realized that, because that was all during the summer of 2020.
Mm.
And there was a lot going on in the country at that time.
Very heightened,
yes. It was heightened, and I felt that as well. You know, I'm in my house over there, and, you know, I feel like, you know, I'm feeling this, and I, now the conversation about this exhibit is about to change.
Yes.
And so I had to say the things, like, I can't just watch this happening and not be able to say the things that need to be said and hope that it's received. And if it's not, then I have to figure out where to go from there. But the great thing about it is it was received.
Yeah.
They heard me. They reacted in a way that uplifted that. And so, yeah, it wasn't easy. And I started to understand about myself that maybe I'm on these projects and in some of these positions for that.
Yes.
Because there has to be the voice. We always talk about, like, well, you need a voice in the room. But even sometimes when there is a voice in the room, you get a little bit nervous about saying anything because you want your job.
Right.
And so I've just taken the power away of that thought by saying to myself, I don't need any job. And I don't need any amount of money to be happy. I don't need any of it. And I'll always find something. Like, I have survived this long in my life, raised a kid by myself, you know, went to school, had 3 jobs, worked full, you know, did all the whole thing. So at this place, I think I'll be okay,
yeah.
You know? So then I had to take that fear away of, like, I'm just going to say it. If they don't like it, they don't like it. But the worst they can do is, you know, show me the door.
Well, yes.
And so that's kind of my way I approach everything, which allows me the freedom to be like, hey, you're going to need to do this. And let's talk about your history. Because I did with them and the president, you know, of the Met. I said, let's talk about 150 years of, you know, the way you have displayed Black culture, and about how you really don't celebrate it in the way. And look, it's successful, right? They heard, they embraced it.
And they saw the results.
And then look at the results. And now they're having another exhibit with a Black curator. This maybe when I was the first female and the Black woman designer at Marvel in 15 years. Because they didn't think a woman could do it.
Right.
Which is
terrifying, because I think that it's been stifled for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're opening up this can, and it's people just like, wow. It's sad. It's very sad when you hear about the first Black female chef or the first this, right. and it's a first woman. It's terrifying that we live like that for so long, and now we're just like...
But when you open up, you're successful.
Yes.
You're successful. Look at Black Panther. Now they've got more women designers. They've got two more women, Kara and Beth. Two more women designers. And it's like, yeah, because that was, I did it, you know? And I held on for dear life to do it because I knew that will move the needle, you know? And this woman brought you an Oscar that you've never had in 15 years from any of the 800 men that you paid twice as much. You paid twice as much as you did me.
Yes.
I brought you that, you know? So why couldn't Kara or why couldn't Beth or any other woman who has the strength and resolve to get through a Marvel film? So I think that they have loosened their, you know, loosened up about who they're bringing in
right.
behind the camera and who's making the decisions and gatekeeping. So, yeah. You know, here I go. And my dad is probably up in heaven like, but I knew it. You would just be the bulldozer who just goes through life just, you know, bulldozing down all this stuff. So, yeah.
Well, congratulations. And thank you for your confidence and your not giving up.
One last question. The way your mind works professionally, seeing the way a set should be designed, a moment of this film, what happens when you go to somebody's house for the first time? All right, that's what I figured. You're not coming to our house.
She's gonna be like, "Well, this should be over
yeah."
Here.
This does nothing to tell the story of them.
I've gotten better over
yeah.
time.
Yeah.
I've gotten better over time.
I was just wondering. Well, Hannah, thank you so much for
thank
being
you.
With us. This is, I mean, we could chat for hours with
yes.
you. Best of continued success.
Thank you so
much. And the wonderful things you're doing in film, outside of film, and just for being a member of our community here in New Orleans.
Well, thank you. And thank you for having me in this lovely conversation. You heard me?
We heard you.
Way to close it up. Make way for the reaper. Make way, here we go, here we go, here we go. Make way for the reaper. Whoa. Make way for the reaper.
Back up, everybody, back up. It was so rough.